On the Empire Podcast this week, everything is awesome as Phil Lord and Chris Miller, directors of the Lego Movie and 22 Jump Street, drop by to discuss their amazing year, while Morten Tildum, director of The Imitation Game, also pops in to talk about his enigmatic film. See what I did there? All that and the usual movie news and nonsense on the only movie podcast that quite frankly doesn't see what all the fuss is about. Landing on a Comet, Bruce Willis did that years ago, and he died for our sins. Easy. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, welcome to the Empire Podcast. This week I'm joined by the greatest threesome since Rita Sue and Bob too. First up is our geek queen who recently visited Bangor, Maine, Stephen King country, and brought us all back a lovely bout of Captain Trips. Isn't that nice? Thanks a bunch, Helen O'Hara.
Hey, you're welcome, Chris. I'm not sure that... Oh, God. I'm not sure that what Bruce Willis landed on was a comet. I think technically that was an asteroid.
It's the same thing, Helen. Uh-huh. Look it up in science books.
Well, okay. I think if anyone's heard our Interstellar podcast, they know that we all know the science already.
Yes, we do. Next up is an art house guru who collects subtitled films like Pennywise the Clown collects souls. It's Phil Dissemblian. How are you, sir?
Hi, Chris.
You all right?
Yeah. I'm very good, thanks very much.
Thanks for joining us from your sewer.
I don't live in a sewer.
Sorry, I'm getting you confused with Pennywise again.
I moved out recently.
Last but not least is another one of those pesky Dissemblian boys. You know the ones, Ellen, you know, they keep appearing in the corridors of Endeavour House, asking me to come and play with them.
They're holding hands. Yeah. It's quite creepy.
You can actually see them as well. They're dressed exactly alike at all times. It's Nick Dissemblian. How are you?
Chris, if you will, pedal around on a tricycle in the corridors.
Health and safety.
Yep. Hello.
That was the weirdest way I've ever said, how are you? I went, how are you? How are you? You've been sending in questions via Twitter, via email, via Facebook. Here are the two that made the cut this week. Elrington James on Twitter, at Elrington James, said, with Toy Story 4 being announced, are there any good fourth movies? And someone else asked this, and apologies, I didn't catch that initial tweet, but someone else did ask this question. Are there any good part the fours?
Now, are we counting A New Hope?
Ooh, sneaky.
Yeah. Already he's in with the tricky ones. So you either look at it this way. The fourth Star Wars movie is either Star Wars, in which case it's brilliant, or it's The Phantom Menace, it's also brilliant. So, yeah.
Well, there are brilliant moments in The Phantom Menace. There was that one bit with Jewel of the Fates.
With the end credits.
There's the bit where it begins, and then it just runs until the end, and everything in between is just like the best thing ever.
There is a good bit with Greg Proops.
There is. But,
I'm gonna posit another sci-fi film, Star Trek, The Voyage Home, which is obviously the one where they go to San Francisco in the 80s.
Yeah. Do you know what? That was generally considered one of the great Star Treks, but there's been a bit of a backlash against that in recent years. I've always quite liked it, actually.
No, you can tell because it's got an even number.
Well, exactly.
How you tell.
That's now reversed in the new series.
Can I just say, I'm totally baffled by the even odd number theory, because I watched the Wrath of Khan followed by The Search for Spock, and they both seem quite good.
Well, actually, The Search for Spock is the best of the odd numbers. But the problem is, Star Trek The Motion Picture number one is unbelievably bad. Star Trek V The Final Frontier is so much worse, you can't even conceive of it.
It does have that great bit where Scotty bangs his head on the Enterprise. He goes, "Ain't no less ship like the back of my hand," and then he bangs his head on the thing. That's good.
That's it.
But there's also the bit where, you know...
There's the bit where he's climbing El Capitan in Yosemite. But no, that's it. Anyway, nothing else in Star Trek V is good. Star Trek VII, disappointing. 9, disappointing. 11, good. And that's where it switched, because then 12 was, let's face it, disappointing.
So it's a double anomaly.
Yeah.
In interstellar parlance.
Indeed.
Mm. Friday the 13th, part 4, the final chapter, isn't bad.
It's a liar, though.
There's the next one called, not really. We were kidding.
Yeah, there's a final chapter and then there's a final Friday, which was proven wrong very, very quickly.
Final chapter and then the back cover.
That's not bad. That's the one with Corey Feldman, where Corey Feldman plays Tommy, and he's a young kid who's into like horror movie special effects, and he takes on Jason at the end. It's also one where Crispin Glover gets killed in a kitchen. So it's pretty good as Friday the 13th movies go.
How about Fast and Furious? Something of a reboot of the franchise, cleared the decks of debris, allowing us to experience the greatness of Fast Five. Yeah, all right, fine, you're not convinced, whatever.
No, we all know that it got good when The Rock came along.
Yeah, we do.
You're a particular fan of the Step Up franchise.
I am, yes.
The universe.
But Step Up 4, I think, was the Miami one.
Revolution.
Yes, Revolution, which was a particularly ludicrous plot, it has to be said. I mean, incredible dance numbers. Genuinely, the dance numbers in that series are better than pretty much anything since Gene Kelly. But the plot of that one is particularly stupid because it has them affecting social change through kind of flash mob style choreography. And that's, I mean, you know, call me a political naive here, but that seems unlikely to me.
I often do. Rocky IV. Come on.
Yes.
Come on.
Okay.
Drago. Yes. Absolutely.
One of the best. The best training montage in a Rocky film.
Oh, yeah. Running up the mountain. Yeah. Contrasting with Drago. It's got the death of Apollo Creed. It's got everything you can want. It's got the best soundtrack. It's got James Brown. It's got Living in America. It's got the Burning Heart. It's got everything you could possibly want.
You wanted the death of Apollo Creed?
I didn't
you
want
monster.
The death of Apollo Creed. And no, of course I don't want the death of Apollo Creed. I want Apollo Creed to live on. Perhaps, I don't know, his grandson in some sort of spin-off in which Rocky is his trainer. I don't know.
You could just call that Creed.
You could call it Creed. It could be directed by Ryan Coogler.
That's crazy. Talk.
Right, let's pitch it straight after this.
That is crazy.
And I'm gonna say Lethal Weapon 4 because I'm wild and crazy.
You're an idiot.
I like it too.
I like Lethal Come Weapon on. 4. I prefer do. Lethal Weapon 4 to Lethal Weapon 3. Yeah, I said it. It's got Jet Li in it.
Yeah.
It's got an unconvincing stunt double of Mel Gibson, who's actually Asian.
Yeah.
We have a feature called...
What, Mel Gibson is Asian?
We have... No, only his stunt double. But we have a feature on the website called Seeing Doubles, where we freeze frame shots of stunt doubles from action films. And so there's a Bruce Willis stunt double in Die Hard who looks exactly like Jerry Seinfeld. And the one that's a bit at the end of Lethal Weapon 4 where Mel Gibson's driving a forklift truck. If you freeze frame it, it's a Chinese man who's about 20. It's amazing. Check that feature out. It's hilarious, especially the Eddie Murphy one in Beverly Hills Cop.
We need to do a sequel. Oh, by the way, Eddie Murphy, I was going to say, was originally meant to be in Star Trek 4. It was originally written as partially going to be a vehicle for him to, you know, do his comedy stylings in, and then they just wrote him out. But that's the most comedic Star Trek entry, Voyage Home, I would say.
Did that feature include any of the late Roger Moore Bond canon entries? Because I was watching View to a Kill, and the bit on the Eiffel Tower,
oh my God.
He makes a leap onto
the
elevator.
We do.
And it looks an awful lot like Les Dawson.
Yeah, or Bernard Manning.
But
he's got an extraordinary wig on. Stuntman, and he looks like he's about 70.
Yeah, not even a younger
stuntman.
A couple
of years older than Roger.
Not even particularly nimble, just someone the same age.
You could do an entire sub-feature on Future Kill.
So good.
Amazing.
Other notable part fours, obviously Police Academy 4, Citizens on Patrol, the last one with Steve Guttenberg. Some might say the saddest Police Academy movie.
Yeah. Are you supposed to put the emphasis on the on?
I did. Citizens on Patrol. That's terrible, that film. Sharon Stone's in it, though. Fourth James Bond film is Thunderball, which isn't that great. The fourth Carry On movie is Carry On Constable, which is also not that great, although it is the first Sid James film.
Oh, well.
He's got nothing to be said.
I actually just watched Carry On Sergeant the other day, and it doesn't really feel like a Carry On without Sid James. He's the missing ingredient.
I have never seen a Carry On film.
Just thought I'd announce that. Not even Nat the Kyber?
Never seen a Carry On film, ever.
Oh, okay. Well. We're going to have to sort out that out.
We're not doing a Carry On-a-thon.
Where should I start?
I will pick...
hypothetically.
It's not like chronologically, it's not like each one feeds into the other. It's not like the Carry On first.
Yeah, exactly. So where do you dip your...
You've got to start at the beginning when they were all quite serious dramas.
No.
Yes.
And then they gradually morphed into comedies.
Avoid all the 70s ones, which are just filled with gratuitous nudity and sex. Hang on, what am I saying? But Carry On Emmanuel is just awful. The last one, Carry On Columbus, is just one of the worst films you will ever see. I would go for like the properly good ones. Yep. So Carry On Follow That Camel, Carry On Don't Lose Your Head, Carry On Screaming, that's also a good one. Yep. There's a whole bunch of early ones that are pretty good.
Up the Khyber is great. Cleopatra I have a big soft spot for as well.
Yes, that's also good.
And Screaming.
And where do I start with Confessions of a Window Cleaner?
You start and you stop there.
Just what you said is enough.
Okay.
Where were they up to with Universal Soldier at part four?
Are they on about eight or now?
No, but what was number four? Do you remember?
Four was the one where they... Wasn't four the one where they brought back Dolph Lundgren and Jean-Claude Van Damme?
I have no idea.
And then our good podcast friend Scott Adkins took over the franchise. I think they're on about six
now. I kind of stopped with that franchise after the first one, I'll be honest.
I heard
a couple of the sequels are good.
Scott Adkins one's pretty good.
Yeah?
Yeah, he went all a bit Apocalypse Now. Quite serious and sort of impressionistic.
Directed by Peter Hyams' son, those movies.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
Dirty Dozen, The Fatal Mission.
Alien Resurrection. Let's move on. Here's a question from Harry Stainer via email. And he asks, basically this is a question for Interstellar Spoiler Special podcast, which is now up. You can go listen to it. It's got Jessica Chastain and Chris Nolan. It's all good. And he asked, I was wondering where Interstellar ranks for you in Nolan's filmography.
Well, let's see. I'd probably put maybe The Prestige. Batman Begins would be my next. Then
is this from best to worst?
This is from best to worst. Then Prestige. Memento. Then Dark Knight. Mm-hmm. Then Inception. Then Insomnia. Then Interstellar.
All the
ends. Yeah. Then The Dark Knight Rises. Ooh. I haven't seen The Following.
Following.
You haven't seen The Following what? You just said Following and then you stopped.
I did, yes, that's okay. Right, I did.
Okay.
I've seen Following. Is it The Following or Following?
No, it's Following.
Did I leave any out?
No.
Okay.
That's your lot.
That was an incendiary list, Helen. I noticed you put Batman Begins above the other the two movies in trilogy.
Can I just say that my list is quite similar to Helen's list?
Do it.
Go on. Is it the same as Helen's list?
It's similar, yeah. I don't know. My favourite of the Batman films is Batman Begins, which I know makes me some kind of like social pariah. But there you go.
It doesn't.
I really love Memento. I think that's probably his best film for me.
Okay.
I love The Prestige. I think those are the ones that I just find the most fun. And a lot of them have had a bit of a fun deficit lately. Yeah.
Humour levels in Nolan films tend to be set at 20%. Nick?
Yeah. I'm going to go... is it Inception or is it The Dark Knight? It's one of those two.
Inception.
I'm going to go Inception, my favourite. I love that film so much. It's fantastic. Love the soundtrack too. It's probably my favourite soundtrack of Hans Zimmer. Dark Knight, Memento... Mm-hmm. I'm not going to do all of them, but I'd say Interstellar's...
Go on, do all of them.
Do all of them?
Yeah,
okay.
Go on. That's what the question is.
Batman Begins is my least favourite of those three films.
Shut the front door.
I've only seen it once, though. I need to probably watch it again, but it was my least favourite.
I know, you do kind of wail on that film from time to time. I need to see it again, I'm telling you, it's really good.
Okay, I'll watch it again. So Dark Knight Rises, Prestige. Mm-hmm. Insomnia is probably the least of them.
Yeah.
Or The Following is probably the least of them.
Following.
Prestige, yeah. I don't know. Is that why I said all of them?
Yeah.
Interstellar's about halfway down.
I'm gonna give you guys a definitive list now. The Dark Knight. Come on, it's brilliant. I love Batman Begins, but The Dark Knight is so much better.
A diamond the size of a statue.
She had a diamond the size of a ruby of the size of a fist. She was only 70. So, okay, The Dark Knight.
The Dark Knight.
Then the Prestige. It's The Prestige. Followed by Batman Begins.
Why's John Major in the room?
That's your Gillian Murphy. What's happening?
Batman Begins is followed by Inception, which is followed by The Dark Knight Rises, which is followed by Interstellar, which is followed by Insomnia, and then following Memento. I don't like Memento.
You don't like Memento.
I don't like Memento.
You don't like Memento. Why do you not like Memento?
I didn't like it.
Controversial.
It was backwards.
Memento. Yes, it was. It was.
Memento, I think, is my number three.
Wow.
It's a good film.
I don't like Memento.
It's Joey Pants.
It's probably his seventh on the list. Memento, and then Insomnia, and then the Following for me. Now I've broken the internet like Kim Kardashian's bottom. If you want to have your question read out on the Emperor podcast, then you can email it to us. You're right, Phil. You're looking at me as if I've gone mad. You can email it to us, podcast@empireonline.com. You can Twitter it to us on the Twits machines. We are at Empire Magazine. Use the hashtag Emperor Podcast. And you can Facebook us, where we are, of course, Empire Magazine. Time now for our first interview, and it's with two of our people of the year. No, not Phil and Nick Dissemblian. It's Phil Lord and Chris Miller, who've put most directors to shame this year, while other directors, of course, cultivate Kubrickian gaps in their CVs. Lord and Miller directed two films this year. And what's more, they were two of the year's best, and certainly the funniest, in The Lego Movie and 22 Jump Street. They were in London this week to boost the former's BAFTA chances. Sadly, I don't think 22 Jump Street has much chance of winning the BAFTA.
It really should, though.
It really should. Ali Plum and I jump-streeted at the chance to talk to them. The first voice you will hear in this interview is Phil Lord. He's the one singing nasally. It was that kind of interview. Enjoy.
Would you like a little test?
Hello.
Yeah. I'm going to take... I'll take the...
You'll take
soprano?
The
I don't know. I'm running away. I don't want...
Squeaky sub-tenor. Like, what's the...
Badoom, badoom.
Yeah. Just the nasal... What's the part of the... The part of the song that's nasal and kind of stuffed up sounding. I can do that.
All of it.
You know how that's an important sound. Yeah, like in a in a beautiful choir, there's that one section that just goes in the middle.
Yeah, feedback.
What is it?
Like in the Hallelujah chorus, there's the.
I don't know what.
That's. I don't know. I'm a student of. Of voice recording.
I'm gonna edit this.
Okay, so. Good. Yeah, yeah, I would hope so.
Yeah, that's definitely open with that. That's gonna, people are gonna definitely stay.
Just drop it in all the way
on
through
this channel. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll just mix in them.
Put it in the background.
Yeah.
Shall I do a big intro?
Begin. Yeah. Let's do it.
Just go for it.
Get the time.
Give you guys a big intro.
Okay, let's hear it.
Okay.
We're delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by Phil Lord and Chris Miller, directors of two of our favorite films this year. I don't know if you're aware of it, guys, but you directed two films this year.
What happened?
Foolish move.
That's a bit insane. Can you pick your favorite between the Lego Movie and 22 Jump Street?
It's Sophie's Choice there, really.
Yeah, that's important.
What child do you love the best?
For parents to choose one child and invest a lot in that one. We're sort of hedging our bets.
It's impossible to pick a favorite.
Yeah.
When you get noticed by your fans on the street, I'm sure this happens
all the time.
You know how the...
We got recognized once in our whole career in an airport.
By your mom.
By my mother, and by two folks, and they were like, Chris and Phil, we turn. And it was, of course, two people coming back from Comic-Con with, like, one was wearing, like, an Iron Man shirt, and the other one was, like, had a Dexter's Lab shirt. I'm like, oh, right, these are our people.
Welcome home.
Yeah.
But do you, when you speak to journalists and fellow fans like ourselves, do you find that there are particular jokes that people come up to you and ask you about? Because people get pretty excited when I'm, certainly my friends, when I talk about both of those movies.
People often will sing Everything is Awesome to us, and we have to apologize to them for sticking that on the world. That's probably the most common thing.
You should never apologize for that song.
That's right.
We shouldn't.
You shouldn't.
Embrace it.
That could be an Oscar-nominated song, which would be the best thing in the whole world.
Huge prank on...
Yeah.
Can you imagine that being performed at the Oscars?
That would be a real dream come
true. It would be
a
great pleasure. If it is performed, I insist that Batman gets to rap in the middle of it.
Will Arnett in the costume, though, right?
Oh, for sure.
Will Arnett in a Batman costume. I'm just pitching this out. We should call Neil Patrick Harris and just tell him, like, hey, we've got some good ideas for you.
Because never mind killing your babies in terms of picking one between 22 Jump Street and the Lego Movie. What if Everything is Awesome and Untitled Self-Portrait both got nominated for Best Song at the Oscars?
Oh, my God.
I think that would really...
What do you do? Which do you... Yeah, well, obviously the votes would cancel each other out.
Right.
Causing like a victory for Lord. Yeah.
What was the phone call like when you told, I guess it was phone call, maybe you wanted to do it person to person, when you told Will Arnett that he's going to get his own Batman movie?
Oh, yeah. We sat him down and we said, Will, I think you need to come into the office. There's something Chris and I need to talk to you about in person. It can't be on the phone.
In truth, I emailed him. That was how it
We did either. Hey, would you be cool if we made a whole movie based on your one character?
And he was like, yes.
But whatever that looks like in an email, which I guess is bold italics.
Emoticons, maybe?
Oh, yeah. For sure. It was very emoticon filled.
Is there a batarang emoticon?
I would imagine. They have an emoticon for just about everything these days.
It's just a frowny face after everything.
I feel like there's an opportunity with that movie to bring back the 60s camp of the original.
Oh yeah.
Rest assured, every era of Batman filmmaking will be acknowledged.
And fully represented.
Yeah.
It is such a wide... There's been so many interpretations of Batman, and there's so much to play with there. You know, just, there have been 40 versions of his origin story alone.
Yeah. Adam West was the last happy Batman.
That's true. Everyone else has been so emo and depressed. So
Adam
hard.
West seems so excited.
So hard to be so handsome and wealthy.
Yeah. But he did it like James Bond, kind of.
Yeah.
Like Roger Moore. Just like, I'm happy to be here.
Yeah. He was the last Batman who didn't really keep up in the gym. He just let himself go a little bit.
Like, I'm really more of a detective, you know. I'm like finding some clues.
I think that's more authentic to a rich playboy. Wouldn't you say?
Let himself go a little bit.
Let yourself go. Yeah, add like 20 extra pounds. Like, the ladies aren't going to really care. You go to a lot of nice restaurants. It's hard to keep your figure
when you're so wealthy and successful.
I have that problem.
Yeah, it's
yeah.
true.
Yeah.
It is so hard.
Mm. Do you guys, I mean, I guess the Lego movie spin-offs and sequels that are being announced, do you look at that as a chance to build in a way like the Marvel Cinematic Universe, the Lego movie Cinematic
sure.
Universe? Will everything feed into everything else? And will you be taking that as a chance to take the Michael, I guess, out of the shared universes that we have these days?
Oh, yeah. Take the Michael out of it.
Yeah.
That's like is that a... That's a broadcast standards qualifying way to say another phrase. Is that what that is?
I could have said take the piss. I don't know why I didn't say take the piss.
Yeah, but I've never heard that one.
Yeah.
So does that, well, I don't know a lot about language. Does that mean Michael is another way to say piss?
Well, no, there's take the Mickey.
Oh, yeah.
And then sometimes we lengthen it.
Oh, is there like a rhyming?
Yeah.
And then take the Mickey, is that rhyming slang for something?
Let's say yes, shall we?
Yeah, let's say yes.
Mickey Bliss.
Yes.
Having a piss. That's
there you
that.
Go.
Oh, make
yeah.
it
yeah.
up.
It is.
Let's go for that. That's
sure.
I just
not?
Made it up, but it sounds
taking
good.
Cool.
I believe it. I'm totally naive American.
I'm just offering Mickey Bliss, guys.
Sure. Yeah. Let's go get a Mickey Bliss after this. What do you think?
Let's go.
Absolutely.
What did I just agree to?
I think urinating together.
Yeah, I guess it's going to be.
That's what's just
it.
Happened.
Don't cross the streams.
Four way.
You know, the thing about these movies is that, you know, each of them has their own tone and their own voice and you know, we're doing this Ninjago one with Charlie Bean and Chris McKay's working on the Batman one, and you know, and each one of them feels like its own movie, but obviously, you know, they all exist in the universe that the Lego movie existed in, and so finding that balance has been part of the trick. But I think Lego
kind of started with the Avengers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
right
and now we're going to spin off and explore the different worlds and then come back.
Yeah.
And how involved are you in the oversight of all that? You know,
surprisingly very involved. We just, you know, we've put together this new place in Hollywood where all the movies are being made together and everyone's helping everybody out.
I wouldn't call it oversight. I would call it more like
suggesting
chaos.
Yeah. Making suggestions regularly.
Yeah. It seems like they're having a lot of fun over there.
It does seem like that.
Yeah. I don't know if they're, maybe they're not, but it seems like they're having a lot of fun. There's certainly a lot of creativity going on in that building, and that's really exciting for us.
This is Lego HQ.
Yes, we call it the Bricksburg Chamber of Commerce. That's what the office is called.
Because we feel like creativity thrives under kind of officious sounding...
Red tape.
Yeah.
A lot of red tape.
Bureaucracies. So we wanted to kind of create a bureaucracy for the films to live under.
Speaking of spin-offs, will there ever be, just for me, if you wouldn't mind, a Captain Dixon spin-off? could we possibly have an origin story?
Oh, yes.
Oh my
like
God,
a,
what
like
a great idea.
Like a 70s blaxploitation film?
We haven't talked about the Jump Street cinematic universe yet.
Absolutely.
Don't even tease me.
I know, that would be amazing.
The JSCU.
Oh my God. Like
copyright 2014 Chris Miller
film. Like a blaxploitation film.
I love it.
Oh, he would go crazy.
He would love
it.
That.
He would love it. Oh, a modern day blaxploitation film starring Ice Cube.
Yeah.
Co-written by Ice Cube and directed by whoever Ice Cube says.
Would Ice Cube play all the roles? Like Andy Serkis?
He would play all the roles, like Orbit. Yeah,
very Eddie Murphy style.
That would be amazing. Because obviously you guys at the end of the Jump Street credits did set yourself set up the next 20 sequels roughly.
Yes, it's more of a suggested pitches than a scorched earth type of situation, or maybe both.
I just felt like the movies you do, and we've talked about this before, but it seems like you like painting yourself into a corner and then having an amazing elaborate backflip out of it. Hey, we're going to do a movie about Lego and Shazam.
Challenge accepted. That's our
one of these days we should
motto.
Just start with the backflip.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah. But
yeah, or start with something that seems like a good idea.
I guess if you started if you started there, you would just do a regular flip.
Yeah.
It's the corner that requires the backflip.
Well put.
Yeah.
That's so
that was
profound.
I tried to extend
life.
That metaphor, yeah. I'm trying to paint a picture for the listening audience, you know. I try to get really vibrant.
Right. It's very much appreciated.
Yeah. I'm picturing them both wearing capes as they do this backflip.
Yeah.
Is that wrong? Or should I be?
Well, we did bring our own capes.
We
for
did.
This
and it must be hard to record our voices with us both being 7 feet tall. It's hard for these microphones to reach.
Yeah. Cables are not long enough.
Yeah.
No, but the reaction now that, the dust has settled to that the joke, the credits joke,
mm-hmm.
was like the people may not have seen the film, but people were telling them, you need to see this film for the credits.
Simply, which is always a good sign.
How does that make you feel?
It's like, you know what's the best part is when it's over.
Yeah. There's an amazing, amazing Benny Hill joke, yes. and then the credits.
Exactly, that's it. Yeah. That's basically the two highlights. Hey, you got to leave them laughing, right? It's better to end with something great than like if we started with credits. And then the movie just went downhill from there. That would have been terrible.
It's true. I mean, that came together very, very late in the process. You know, we had originally this joke that they said, well, you ready? What do you do for the next mission? And they said, we're never doing this again, and walked away into the mm-hmm. sunset. Mm-hmm. And then we were going to do a sort of the next movie with two different actors as a joke. But we tested it, and the audiences were so sad that the characters didn't want to do it. And so we said, oh, you want to see those guys doing it? Oh, we'll give you those guys doing it. And we called them and said, hey, we want to shoot something. Are you free next week?
The audience wanted them to live happily ever after.
Right. Yeah, because it's a romantic comedy. Yeah. It's a romantic comedy.
So this was our way of saying that.
Yeah, they don't worry. They'll stay together forever.
Yeah. Even in the outer space.
But I mean, on a serious note, again, I'm a big fan. How likely are we to get another, in whatever form, story with those guys?
It's quite possible. We're developing something that Rodney Rothman, who was one of the writers on the last movie, is writing a script for, and it is yet crazier, completely different. Who knows if it'll all come together or how it'll come together.
Is it in the Lego universe?
It's all set in the Lego universe.
You know, it's almost
it's a
as
fully
crazy
animated.
It's as crazy of an idea
it's
as that.
It's a stop motion, animated.
Full of swear words. Lego movie,
Yeah. We're going another way. We're trying to get the smallest possible audience for the third film. It's going to be a stop motion, black and white.
So that one time people recognized you hated that. You don't want that to ever happen again. So you want to make the smallest possible audience film so it never happens.
Yes. Yeah. This is all to launch our independent filmmaking career.
That's right.
When I first spoke to you guys, mm-hmm. the Comic-Con before last.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I know, right? I asked you whether we'd possibly get some Technic cameo or maybe some Duplo cameo.
Yes.
And you both went,
I can't tell you.
And then you started singing. But yeah, it was...
Then I started singing with my nose.
It was pretty great.
Yeah.
But yeah, we got a bit of Duplo right at the very end.
It's true.
Can we get some more Technic maybe in Batman?
In Batman specifically, this is a request.
It might happen. It might Technic, happen. Yeah. I can't
That's
promise.
True. There were definitely Technic parts and pieces in the movie. Not especially featured, but there was definitely Technic.
In Lego 2, I think you'll be a lot... Technic freaks will be satisfied.
There's a decent bit of Technic in Lego 2, it's true.
So hold on.
I don't know about Batman yet, but yeah. But there also is Duplo in Lego 2 as well.
Doesn't Technic have those weird, very tall figures? Like those like racing looking guys?
Yeah. Almost Playmobil, but not really.
Yeah, they're cool looking. They look like more like a 4-inch tall like Star Wars figures. I'm not promising those.
You have started something though, because there is a Playmobil movie happening.
I heard that.
Oh, for
I
real?
That. Yes. Yeah.
This is
news
to me. I'm finding out this news.
Yes, it was announced yesterday, which is crazy.
I hope it's just a slightly taller version of the Lego movie.
Just shot for shot.
Slightly.
Everything's a little taller.
Suddenly,
it's not in 2.35. They had to do it.
185.
185 to accommodate the extra height.
So we talked about how you guys like to paint yourselves into a corner and then backflip back out again.
Yeah. We're very athletic. That's another thing. It's important for the listening audience to know. Extremely well developed quadricep muscles.
We had to bring in extra big armchairs.
Yeah,
we just didn't fit in them.
Very muscular.
Yeah.
But one corner you chose not to backflip out of was Ghostbusters 3. Now, did that ever come close? Was that ever a real decision for you guys to make to take or not to take that film?
I think it was. Broadly exaggerated in the media. I think, you know, we had very, very loose discussions because we are at, you know, we do a lot of work with Sony and we are friends of the court there. So that was a big priority for them. And they talked to a lot of different people about that. And ultimately, Paul Feig came up with the idea that kind of broke it open. Which I don't think, which we certainly didn't have. But I think that's going to be a great movie, and we're really excited as fans of the franchise, you know, to have them start it up again. And they've pulled the Ecto-1 out of storage and put it on the lot so you can walk past it now. And, it's going to be really cool.
That's pretty cool. But I guess at the same time, are you guys wary of being pigeonholed as those guys?
The crazy adaptation dudes.
You know, I do think that it gets a lot of people saying like, these guys take bad ideas from movies and make them into movies. So, hey, we've got a bad idea for a movie. Let's pitch it to them.
Yeah. I'll better tear out this page.
Yeah. Yeah.
Never mind.
Podcast a movie would be
sure. Yeah. We should do an adaptation right now.
It does feel like we're just always trying to take a dare of like, can you make this into a movie?
Yeah, those Coca-Cola polar bears, they're really interesting. No one's told their story yet.
The holidays are coming.
The holidays are coming. Yeah, it's like Santa Claus. They one of their kind attacks Santa Claus and scalps him and eats his face off, and then they realize they've got to do something to save Christmas. Mm-hmm.
So one of them pretends to be Santa.
So one of them wears Santa Claus's skin and goes around and visits children.
Fun for the whole family.
Santa Claus.
Santa Claus with the bear claws.
Guys.
Dude, we just made some money.
That's good. How much money did we make?
God, I love making money.
We're going to get so rich off that idea.
$5 million podcast.
Again, it's great being handsome, tall, muscular, and successful.
It really is, and having great ideas and huge, humongous
brains.
No flaws
whatsoever.
Large brains, like Megamind, kind of. Yeah.
This is another wide question, but some movies have come out this year that haven't been yours. I know you did too, but of the ones that you didn't do, what have been your favorite?
Oh goodness,
so many.
And there's so many things we haven't seen because we've been really busy.
And we missed a whole bunch of them because we were busy making two movies at once, which I don't recommend if you want to have any personal life whatsoever.
Right. Or find out what's happening in the rest of cinema at the same time.
There's so many.
What's your favorite so far? I think mine is still Whiplash, but I have to caveat that by saying there's a million things I haven't seen.
It's true. I mean, gosh, there's a lot of movies I really
It's award season, after all. Who gets the Chris Miller Award?
Boy, man, it's very hard to pick. I mean, there's, like, as far as, like, big tentpole type of movies, I really like Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Mm-hmm. I really liked Edge of Tomorrow, which was
underperformed, but it was awesome. Yeah.
It was really fun.
It's Tom Cruise's best. That gets best Tom Cruise performance of this century.
Yeah, I mean,
this millennium. Yeah,
high praise indeed.
You know, I thought Boyhood was really like extended beyond the gimmick of what it was into something really, really interesting. I've got so many. I can't pick. Come on.
Yeah.
Acceptable answers. A toss up between your two and Phil's got.
Oh man.
Yeah. Who's your? Which is your favorite?
Whiplash yet, but you were.
Which is
going
your favorite? Tilda Swinton.
Oh man.
Heavy makeup performance of the year.
So that's between Grand Budapest Hotel, Only Lovers Left Alive, and Snowpiercer.
Yeah.
Those are our Tilda Swinton.
I'm sure she did other roles that I didn't recognize her in because she was in so much makeup. Much.
She was Tom Cruise in Edge of Tomorrow.
Yeah, exactly.
Is that right?
Yeah. That was her.
She's incredible.
Well, she did a great job.
It was
as
so
Tom
good.
Cruise.
It's actually pretty embarrassing, but you do know she's in the Lego movie.
She is.
I believe it.
You know the guy at the end who's the dad?
She's the dad.
She
plays
Will
Ferrell.
I get it now. It all makes so much more sense.
It's a star-making turn
I think Grand Budapest Hotel, I really liked it. She was great as a super old lady in that.
She's such a sexy vampire, though.
There's another great movie in the works. Super Old Lady.
Super Old Lady is one of. It's actually that's an obscure Marvel title that Disney is going to be adapting next year.
The Wealthy Dowager.
Yeah.
Wait, Super Old Lady :
The Wealthy
Dowager.
Exciting.
You know how to title movies for the family marketplace.
That's right.
If I have one skill, it's selling movies about old ladies.
Right. Yeah, sure.
Well, I mean. Maggie Smith
again, making money.
Down Abbey. There's a great wealthy dowager old lady.
How about that Best Exotic Marigold Hotel?
Yeah.
Or its sequel, the second Best Exotic Marigold. I mean,
they're really selling themselves
old
short.
Old ladies are making money.
That's
right. What it's all about.
Old ladies.
The film business. making that money.
I mean, on that wonderful note, it's all about making the money.
That's right.
Yeah.
For us, it's really not about the quality of the work or the passion for filmmaking. It's really
We're all here. We should also say for our listening audience, we're sitting on huge gold
stacks of gold
coins right now.
It's a bit like Smaug's bedroom in here.
Yes, it is.
We're wearing Scrooge McDuck outfits.
We've been talking for 22 minutes. How much money have you both made in that time?
Oh, my goodness.
Well, anytime you say the number 22,
we
make $1.50, which is equal to
it's a weird residual deal that we got. But thank you for that.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's just time. Don't thank me. Thank time.
I mean, you know how much money there is in podcasting, so we're just happy to spread it around.
Yes.
Yes. Oh, my gosh.
We make 22% of this podcast.
I will give that to you as soon as this is over.
Oh, yeah. I bet you will.
If I know my maths. Anyway, thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. This was really fun.
It was a real pleasure.
And until, I guess, 23, 24, 25, or whatever, Jump Street.
Or Super Old Lady.
Or Super Old Lady. Yeah. For Santa Claus.
Lord.
Yeah. Thanks, guys. Thanks so much.
Cheers.
Those guys are awesome. And I wish, no offense to any of you guys, but I wish I didn't know you and I just knew them instead.
To be honest, Chris, we all feel the same way.
Yeah.
About you.
No offense.
No offense.
No offense, but you're all terrible people.
No offense, but they're better than you are. I mean, that's not even controversial. They just are.
Well, that's debatable, isn't
it? It's not really debatable.
Okay, rank.
I think the
rank,
box office speaks for itself.
Okay, well, while we're ranking things this episode, rank me and Lord Miller.
Okay, so there's Phil Lord and Chris Miller, right? Yeah. Then there's a lot of people.
Daylight.
Uh-huh. Right? Daylight's coming through, like, in every direction. Uh-huh. And then there's some people that I went to school with who I find a bit unpleasant. Uh-huh. And then there's some more daylight, and then there's you.
I'm going to rank everyone the same. Do you know why? Because everyone is awesome.
Aww.
I don't believe that. I hate you.
That turned around fast.
Yeah, that escalated quickly. Time for now for some movie news. What do we have this week? What's been happening? We talked about the Creed spin-off. That's been confirmed, hasn't it? That's going to happen. That's starting in January. Mm.
Yes, it is. Mm. With, of course, Michael B. Jordan starring as Apollo Creed's grandson.
That's exciting. So that'll be interesting to see. Genuinely excited about that film. Yeah. Stallone is back as Rocky Balboa. He's going to be training the son, the grandson of Apollo Creed.
Sounds a bit like a Beverly Hills Cop spin-off they were talking about.
No, I think it'll be a very different thing to that.
Yeah. I never saw the light of day, so weird, because it was produced by Sean Ryan, who did The Unit and The Shield and whatnot. And it's like, okay, that's a bit weird.
Why not? There's a lot of love out there for the Creed, though.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are going to be very excited about the film. And the fact it's from the guys who did Fruitvale Station, Michael B. Jordan and Ryan Coogler, yes, please, I want to see that film.
Yes, indeed. I've got some news. Well, I was hoping to bring part three of my Jobs trilogy to the podcast, but there's literally no news on that. And I'm not even going to make something up. We'll just have to wait to see what is happening cast-wise. But
Stallone has ruled himself out, of course, by doing Creed in January, which means he can't be Steve Jobs.
Damn.
Would you like to buy an iPod? There's new iPod Nano.
Is that Jose Mourinho? Is the second choice. Michelle McLaren. We've been talking about the possibility of a woman directing the Wonder Woman movie, and it looks like that might be coming to pass with Michelle McLaren. And I've got five facts about Michelle McLaren, who's currently in talks to take the role. Number one, she's Canadian. Number two, she directed the Vince Gilligan scripted episode of The X-Files, John Doe. Something that Nick could probably recite literally sort of word by word. She went on to direct 11 episodes of Breaking Bad, including Madrigal, which I think is episode 2 of the final season. Mm. So look out for a Skinny Pete and Badger cameo in Wonder Woman. Also went on to do some Walking Dead. And final fact about Michelle is she loves Sergio Leone. So she's all right by me.
Absolutely. Oh, by all of us. She directed the train heist episode of Breaking Bad as well, which is probably the most cinematic episode of that show, which is saying something, of course.
Yes.
This is good news.
I think so.
Yeah, I think so. She's done, also worth mentioning, she's done some Game of Thrones, which may be relevant if they go for the sort of Themyscira, you know, route to Wonder Woman's origins and actually show her there, because she's got some experience in fantastical worlds.
Yeah, and I think in the context of Wonder Woman, it sounds like good news. She's very talented.
Yeah.
She's done a lot of great TV on a cinematic scale. And for women directors to get, you know, a big blockbuster, we've been talking about it online quite a lot.
Yeah,
it's
amen.
Good to see. So there you go.
Has she directed a film before? This is her first film?
No,
this would be her first film.
This would be her first film, yes. Okay. But she has worked for powerful showrunners like Vince Gilligan and Chris Carter, obviously. So she's presumably well-versed in, you know, the dynamic of working with a studio.
It is interesting, though, the gamble that people are taking these days. A lot of studios are taking gambles on filmmakers who either started off with indie films
obviously Colin Trevorrow going from the likes of Safety Not Guaranteed straight onto Jurassic World, or Josh Trank going straight from Chronicle to the Fantastic Four, or sometimes they just give people lots of money for the first movie, like Rupert Sanders and Snow White and the Huntsman, and go, here you go, here's a big tentpole. And it's interesting, I think if you have a nice, good support group around you, like you might have at Marvel, and I imagine Warner Brothers are trying to put something in place similarly for their DC universe, that could work. But if you leave someone, I think, who's a newbie, a rookie, on their own, then that's when problems can arise, like 47 Ronin, I would say. Yeah. So hopefully that won't happen.
I think that's a big discussion, that one. Yeah. Really interesting stuff. Yeah.
And she's less of a newbie maybe than he was, I think. Absolutely. It's fair to say.
And this is I think probably, I saw someone tweet this last night on Twitter, the first decision that the Warner Brothers have made with the DC Universe, you look at it and you go, oh, actually that makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay, I can see where they're going with this.
This makes a whole world of sense, Happy Days.
Indeed.
I think. Not just because she's a woman, but because she's got some kick-ass work behind her.
So Quentin Tarantino has announced that he might be retiring after 10 films.
What are we up to?
Well, this is the thing, because with Tarantino, the maths gets pretty complex. Mm. Now, I've added it up. He's made 6 films.
Okay.
7 if you count Kill Bill as 2.
Okay.
And Grindhouse is half.
Sure.
Four Rooms is a quarter. Am I making this unnecessarily complicated?
No.
I'll go with it.
So I think he's, as I calculate it, he's up to 6 3/4.
Right.
What? Hang on. No, he's not, because Hateful Eight is his 8th movie.
Yeah, okay, but he hasn't made that yet.
No, but he's about to.
Okay, right. So that's 7 3/4.
Is that... Seven and three quarters. So
I'm only counting Death Proof as Grindhouse as half.
That's probably fair. All right, so
he's going to need to make a sequel to Four Rooms to bring it up to a complete digit.
Yeah.
I think everyone's clamoring for that.
Yeah, you're right. He's
right.
7 3/4. Okay.
So he has to make a Four Room sequel. That's the big news. Because otherwise he's not going to get to 10.
That's what we've extrapolated.
So that's that news. Okay. And my other news is about Fast and Furious. Justin Lin is saying that he may be coming back for a multiple picture thing, which will finish the Fast and Furious franchise.
Ooh. Yeah. Intriguing. Because he moved off to do...
He went off to make Bourne.
Yes, and then that seems to have gone on the back burner since Greengrass and Damon came back.
Yeah.
Is that... I mean, presumably if he's talking about going back for...
I don't know if that's happening. I mean, I actually sat on a plane next to him as he was reading the script for his Bourne film. That was quite exciting. I walked past it and said Bourne on it, and I was like, I didn't ask to read it.
Did you look over his shoulder and went...
Yeah, the entire flight. Meanwhile, that was a good bit.
Dialogue, basically. Well, what's Jason Bourne up to, Aaron Cross? And Aaron Cross goes, nobody cares about me.
Yeah.
And just sits down and cries.
So will they do a trilogy to bring that up to 10?
Ooh,
well,
intriguing.
When Lucas Black signed on, didn't he? He's not in Fast and Furious 7, but he's returning as his character from Fast and Furious Tokyo Drift.
Yep.
And no, I don't know what his name is in that movie. He's returning...
Gil Nitro.
Yes, exactly. Yep. Gil Nitro. He's returning, and he signed on for 3 films to take it up to 10. But these are all going to be shot at the same time, if it happens.
So they might be shooting a trilogy back-to-back. We've just made that up, but let's say that's happening.
Might as well.
The Fellowship of the Rock.
Yes.
I haven't got a title for the second one.
The
third
pecs.
One's Return of the Vin.
The two pecs.
The two pecs and Return of the Vin.
You're welcome, Universal.
The Two Towers, incidentally, is what Vin Diesel calls his testicles.
If you guys are just going to make up news, can I do my job story?
You might as well, go for it.
Oh, okay.
We're speculating.
Yeah, fair enough.
I have a story, and it revolves around Uncharted. So this is the adaptation of the video game, the sort of Indiana Jonesy video game, but honestly, it's not a rip-off, honest. They've been trying to make this forever. At one point, David O. Russell was going to make it. Mark Wahlberg was going to star for him. I think that was shortly after I Heart Huckabees that came up. It is now not something either of them are involved with. Apparently, the Drake role, Nathan Drake, the... Central Treasure Hunter. The role was offered to Chris Pratt, who would seem an obvious choice after Star-Lord. Too obvious, obviously, because he turned it down. Apparently too close to his Jurassic World character as well. But there is good news. Apparently, Zero Dark Thirty's writer Mark Bowell is going to take a crack at the script. And that can only be a good thing. He is a seriously good writer. He's got a real feel for kind of grounded reality in his films to date. So, you know, maybe he's going to give this a bit more of a kind of gritty, realistic edge.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a huge fan of these games. This might be my favourite game series. That doesn't make any sense to me, because these games are not grounded and gritty in any way. I really don't think that there's a great need to turn these games into a film in the way that The Last of Us I can see working. It's got a really great storyline, interesting characters. I love Uncharted, but my love of Uncharted is not because of the characters and story necessarily. It's because they're so fun. The set pieces are so fun.
Uh-huh.
And it's very silly and moves really fast. But I don't... They seem... Hollywood seems determined to turn this into a film franchise, and I can't quite see why.
Well, we do already have Indiana Jones, which does, you know, put that big question mark over it.
So maybe there's a hole in that, you know, they want to...
Maybe.
...do some kind of Indiana Jones thing, because they're not making those films anymore. I don't know. But
I don't know. It's a strange one. I mean, Hollywood has yet to make a great video game movie, it's fair to say. I think, you know, they've made just about passable video game movies, and that's about as good as we've gotten. There hasn't been a great one yet, and we're still sort of waiting and hoping, I guess, that something like Assassin's Creed or The Last of Us or something will finally prove that it can be done, but there's no sign of it so far. Anyway, I mean, yeah. if he's a smart guy, he's not going to hopefully...
He's a great screenwriter.
He's hopefully not going to bring in a tone that doesn't fit, so maybe he's just going to give it some kind of realistic edge and then, you know, keep the silliness. In any case, it's at least forward motion on a project that many of us had assumed was...
It makes more sense than David O. Russell, who was who wrote the previous draft.
Yeah.
So there's that.
I don't know. David Russell has a sense of playfulness in some of his films, Three Kings, for example, and I Heart Huckabees, that I don't think Mark Boal has. In just judging from his film work, I'm sure he's a laugh riot in real life.
These are fairly silly games with the characters quipping, and there's definitely a very light tone to it. So it's going to be interesting to see whether that is.
Yeah, and fair play to Chris Pratt, I think, for turning it down. He doesn't want to get stuck in that same rut of playing the same character over and over again, or the same type of character over and over again.
He actually would be a good Nathan Drake, so it's a shame.
He would. I mean, if he's got Guardians of the Galaxy on one hand as Star-Lord and Jurassic World on the other hand, he kind of has Han Solo and Indy already taken care of.
True.
You know, if we're continuing that comparison, so he's probably right. He doesn't need another similar role.
Plus, at a certain point, a lot of these actors in Hollywood, the ones who especially get involved in the Marvel and the DC universes, are basically just going to go, well, guys, I don't have time to do anything else.
He's already got two franchises, a TV series.
Mm. Well, it's coming to an end.
It's coming to an end.
Plus a Lego movie.
So three franchises already.
I'd like to see Mark Boal do that Triple Frontier thing with Catherine Bigelow.
Yeah, what happened to that?
I don't know. That's a drug... set on the sort of border, I think, of Colombia and Peru.
Wasn't Tom Hanks attached to that at one point? Wasn't that the one that Tom Hanks was attached to? And Jeremy Renner as well?
I'd love to see a film set in, following that Tom Clancy movie, Clear and Present Danger, set in the drug cartel country. Yeah. It was a really interesting stories there and a world I'm not really familiar with. I'd like to see that film.
Yeah, so it was confirmed this week, wasn't it, Phil, that Matt Damon said, yes, I'm coming back to Jason Bourne. Paul Greengrass is coming back to direct, which is all I ever needed to say yes. I'm excited about this. I'd be really intrigued to see where they can take the character, and maybe that'll be a great part for a good friend, Elrington James.
Yeah.
You know? But yeah, I think it's very, very interesting. But the big news, Hollywood was very kind to us last week when they broke the Toy Story 4 news and Star Wars The Force Awakens on Thursday night, so we had time to discuss it in last week's podcast. And then they went and did what they usually do, which was the news broke that Jared Leto is in negotiations to play the Joker in David Ayer's Suicide Squad, which would be the first post Batman v Superman : Dawn of Justice movie in the DC universe in 2016. And the story broke last week that he's in negotiations, he's in discussions to maybe play the part, that David Ayer, that the Joker wasn't initially in the script for Suicide Squad. The Joker will make his big screen debut in our DC cinematic universe without Batman. That makes sense to me.
Unless there's a scene of, you know, Batman capturing him, bringing him in, and that's when...
I want a movie first. Yeah. What do you think? Jared Leto, Joker?
I mean, he's a more likely and more obvious choice than Heath Ledger, and Heath Ledger turned out pretty well, so I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt. I think he's actually pretty good at playing the dark side, Jared Leto, and he showed some hella good acting chops in Dallas Buyers Club, so I'm kind of okay with this.
It's going to be a real challenge for any actor taking on the Joker now, because the Jack Nicholson thing, not only was there a long time between those two films, but Jack Nicholson's an older guy. It was such a different, you know, casting a young guy in itself was like completely rebooting the character. And now Jared Leto, about the same age as Heath Ledger was when he did The Dark Knight, that's going to be tough to do something completely
separate. Actually, he's about 10 years older than Heath Ledger was when he did The Dark Knight. He just looks the same age because he's freakishly well-preserved.
How old is Jared Leto?
He's 43 or something.
Shut the front door.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah.
Wow. Comes with a lot of baggage. He's going to have to answer a lot of Heath Ledger questions, I would imagine, along the way. And I don't know. Good luck to him.
And of course, he's not signed on yet. I mean, this is the thing I was just talking about. It, you know, for any actor now taking one of these things on, it's not just one film. He's not, the Joker isn't just going to be in Suicide Squad. He'll pop up in one of the Justice League movies, although he won't be a, you know, a main antagonist, I'd imagine, because he's not powerful enough. But
and they are talking about a Batman standalone, which they haven't dated yet, but that is on the cards, apparently, we're told. So.
Absolutely. Whereas Heath Ledger, for obvious tragic reasons, and Jack Nicholson only got one go round at the Joker, whereas this, you know, Leto would be looking at this going, oh, this is a 4, 5, 6 year commitment for me. Ooh, I'm not sure about it. I imagine it's much the same reason that Joaquin Phoenix passed in Doctor Strange. It's not just one movie anymore. You're going to be signing away 5 years of your life.
Yeah, it will be. I think it'll be a test of whether or not he's a fan, because quite frankly, if he isn't, he's got no compelling reason to sign up to that. You know, he has a lot going on in his life with his music and so on. At this point, he has an Oscar. I mean, he barely acts in terms of, you know, in terms of how many films he's made and got an Oscar for his trouble, because he's very good when he does. So, you know, it'll purely come down to whether or not he fancies it, I think. I will say, though, Margot Robbie was once again named as Harley Quinn this week. Again, it's not 100% official confirmation, but it looks very much like she's taking that role. And I think that's terrific casting. I think her face, genuinely, is brilliant for that role. And Harley Quinn has become this incredibly popular character. If you ever go to any kind of conventions, Comic-Con as we do, and things like that, you will see so many people dressed as Harley Quinn. It's unbelievable. Her influence is huge, and I think she's a very, very good choice for that role.
Jared Leto's going to look super in whiteface makeup as well.
I hope it's a funny Joker again. Heath Ledger, obviously brilliant, but not a funny Joker.
True.
Very, very intense, dark. So it'd be nice to have a Joker who's actually, you know, Nicholson was a funny character to watch, entertaining character. So,
and I can absolutely
bring it back that way.
I can absolutely see why David Ayer has asked for the character to be included in Suicide Squad, along with the likes of Lex Luthor and Deadshot. There was talk of Jai Courtney's in negotiations with Deadshot, who's a deadly assassin in the DC universe. Because you want your heavy hitters, don't you? You want the big names. And you can just imagine if you get the characterizations right and you have all this group of nefarious evildoers and you drop the Joker, who's the ultimate, you know, wild card, just complete loose cannon nutcase. Just drop him into the middle of any scene and you're just going to have a fun on your hands.
Is it going to be like the 60s Batman film where all the villains are sharing a bedsit? I love those scenes.
It is weird though, because, you know, you're right, he's the ultimate nut job and he's completely uncontrollable, or he should be. And so I don't see what handle the government can possibly have on him to make him work for Suicide Squad. I know he's occasionally been there in the comics, but it's a weird one. So I'll be interested to see how they make that work. Maybe it'll be almost a proto-Joker in this and he'll sort of go full-on whack job at the end. I don't know. But it's an odd one.
If they introduce him briefly then in Dawn of Justice, if they'll reshoot something or...
Yeah.
Who knows?
Is this film not set in the Second World War?
We don't know that yet.
I thought David Ayer said that it was going to be Dirty Dozen style.
I think it means in just the
means
tone
in terms of,
rather
yeah.
than it's
yeah.
not going to be set in the Second World War.
Not necessarily,
That would make no sense.
There has been a Suicide Squad in the Second World War, but we don't know that this is that.
We know Lex Luthor's in the film, for example.
Yeah, we do.
Okay, right. That's plenty movie news. Thank you, Hollywood. You've been very, very generous this week. Time now for a second interview. Morten Tilden burst onto the scene with Headhunters in 2011. It was a Norwegian thriller, of course, based on Jo Nesbø's novel, which plunged its hero literally into a world of shit. He's doing it again, metaphorically speaking, this time in The Imitation Game, which tells a fascinating true-life tale of Alan Turing, the genius who fought against incredible odds and turned the tide of World War II. Helen and Ali Plum spoke to Morten this week.
Morten Tilden, welcome to the Empire Podcast. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for letting me come.
And congratulations on the Imitation. I keep saying that. Congratulations on the Imitation Game, which I really enjoyed.
Oh, thank you so much.
Am I the only one who does that? Intimidation.
That's the first one. The Invitation Game. I heard a few times. No, the Imitation Game. It's based on a paper that Alan Turing wrote.
He's a fascinating figure and you know, a hero of the war, frankly. But, you know, he was only actually sort of pardoned officially on, I think it was Christmas Eve 2013, when you must already have been up and running on the film.
We actually wrapped. He was pardoned a month after we wrapped, which is, I mean, I think it's great that he's been pardoned. It puts a focus on his life, and in many ways, he should be the one that pardons us.
Exactly.
It's really hard. I mean, his achievements were so staggering. I mean, we all owe him so much, and then to think about the injustice that he suffered. You know, we've been prosecuted for being a gay man and sent to chemical castration. I'm just you know, it gets shivers just thinking about it. I mean, and it's completely destroyed him. And all his achievements, or most of his achievements, you know, was kept secret for so long, for so many decades.
When you first became part of this project, where was it?
It was a script that was sent to me. I mean, I moved to Hollywood after done Headhunters, which is a action thriller. You know, it's a Coen-ish dark action thriller. And I read scripts where there were mostly superheroes and heist films and action thrillers. And then my agent sent me this script and said, it's just such a beautiful script. It's probably not what you're looking for, but just read it. And I read it. And I always loved history. And I always thought I knew much about history. And I was just blown away how much of Alan Turing's life I wasn't aware about. Mm-hmm. So I became a little bit obsessed with the whole thing. And I think as a filmmaker, you don't get to pick your project. You fall in love with them. It's certainly you become obsessed with something and you just have to do it. And I never really been into period films. And so I was like, shit, I'm going to do actually a period movie. Okay, so where do I begin? So it was a little bit like that. But it's been such a humbling, and it's been so rewarding to be allowed to tell the story of Alan Turing on the big screen.
Was Benedict Cumberbatch part of the project when you were on board, or was it?
No, he was not. And
so you auditioned him then?
I didn't have to. I mean, I knew him well as an actor, and I actually thought about him when I read the script. So he was the first actor to come to mind, and I could sort of like see him before me when I've been reading it. So to me, I sort of like made up my mind. So I had this Skype call with him. I think it was after Golden Globe or something like that, because he was really hangover. And I tried to convince him to be part of this, and he tried to convince me to be part of it because he read the script and loved it. So we both had, you know.
It went well then.
It went really well. So he came aboard, and you know, he was, as I was, you know, he really wanted to do right on Alan Turing, you know, to really do justice to this man. And he worked so hard. I mean, to make, you know, this, and there's no recording on how Alan Turing walked or talked. You know, you had to sort of like piece him together. And I think the whole movie is made up as sort of like a mystery movie, right? Who is Alan Turing? You know, it's told as a puzzle in many ways. Mm-hmm. And the answer should be, you know, Alan Turing in the end. It's mm-hmm. and that's how he was for us. You know, he was a mystery, he was a puzzle, and we had to sort of like piece him together.
You said earlier that there was so much to Alan Turing's life that you just weren't aware of, because I think people, if they know him at all, know him as, you know, the grandfather of modern computing. Yep. Perhaps, you know, him and Babbage are mentioned in the same sentence often. Is there anything that you wanted to put in, or if you could tell the entire story of Turing, would you have liked to have mentioned, perhaps?
There's several things. I mean, there's things that we had in the script for a while. That one of them was that he was sent to New York to lie to the Americans about the Enigma. I think that's a great story.
Really? What's that story?
You know, they broke Enigma. They didn't want anybody to know it. So the Americans said, how are you guys doing? You know, can you come up and learn, teach us, you know, what you found out? And so they sent Alan Turing out there to lie. And to what actually later became the CIA. It wasn't called CIA at that time, but it's later became that. The way he lied was by, you know, by actually explaining some of his theories, and they're so complicated that it just goes over your head completely. That's really fascinating. And I said, oh, we gotta have it in, but we didn't find room for it in the story, and it took away from the, you know, the narrative and the, you know, I always wish that could be part of it. And also, there's so much about. He actually was a great philosopher. The Imitation Game is a beautiful paper. It actually deals with what it means to be alive. Mm-hmm. What does it mean to be human? To think. I mean, there's a little bit in the movie. You know, this is one of my favorite lines is, you know, just because somebody thinks differently than you doesn't mean they're not thinking. Why cannot the machine one day think, even if it thinks differently? Mm-hmm. And will it then be alive? I mean, he was obsessed with artificial life, artificial intelligence. I mean, he sort of like tried to recreate a soul, yeah, recreate a loss, you know, and it was like his driving force his whole life. So, you know, you could almost like make a movie out about that.
I feel like there's a horror movie where the bomb comes to life.
Yeah.
The way it sounds, the machine, which is very clickety-clack, it's almost like steampunk, really.
Yeah.
What was it like on set shooting that? Was it making those noises? Was this
done? It
was post-production?
It's to us and to Alan, I mean, the machine was like a living thing, and you know, all the red cables, like it's the blood veins, and it's based on how it looks. I mean, the colorful dials and all that, that's how it was. I mean, the size of it, that's the correct size. It was huge, so we sort of like just open it up so you can sort of like see the inside and the pulsing and all the blood streaming in many ways. So it's
I was wondering where it is now. Where
it's actually at Bletchley Park.
Oh, that
machine we had in the movie is now at Bletchley Park. There's an exhibit, which is phenomenal. So now there's an exhibit at Bletchley Park where the machine we built for the film, as well as some other props and some of the wardrobe of that Benedict wore, is now part of an exhibit. And we did, you know, we had math experts. We also had someone, an expert, explain to us how Alan Turing's machine worked, which is really terrifying because it takes 10 seconds and you understand, I'm not going to understand anything of this. It is so complex. It is so beyond anything we could do. A lot of the thing you see in the film, like every Enigma machine is actual Enigma machines from the war.
Wow.
It's really relics that the Nazi used. And we tried to have as many real things from the story as possible. Like the crossword puzzle you see is the crossword puzzle Alan Turing made.
Oh, yeah, and he put it in a newspaper to attract Keira Knightley and her type.
He'd used it to recruit people to MI6,
yeah.
Crossword puzzle, which is just mind-blowing in itself. And we tried to solve the crossword puzzle, and, you know, we couldn't even do that. I think there's a big difference between being, you know, a filmmaker or an actor and being sort of like a math genius or a puzzle solver.
Yeah.
Possibly silly question. Have you seen U-571? Which was the American film about supposedly capturing an Enigma machine.
No, I know about it. Okay. I know they didn't capture the Enigma machine. They captured the sheet of paper where all the settings were, which is kind of, the Germans had this every month. Or every second month actually, they gave up sort of like with 60 days of settings that the submarines and the ships had, and it was written in an ink that when it got wet, the ink dissolved. So they always had a bucket of water or something like that. So if they were captured, they put the papers in it. And it's a true story, which is actually phenomenal, is that they got hold of this because when they had to leave the submarine, it was being captured, and the German officers ordered them to evacuate. The operator had this book of love poems from his wife.
Right.
And he become obsessed about saving that. So he forgot to destroy the sheet.
Because the love of his wife.
Yeah, because the love of his wife. It's part of the story around Bletchley, because they used that was important as part. We didn't have it in our film because it didn't have that tremendous effort. It was more like it's because, you know, then the 2 months went and they lost the settings again. So the brilliant here was that, you know, because the Germans changed settings every 24 hour, and it's 159 million possibilities, which is like, it's Enigma is unbreakable. So it is unbreakable. The thing that Alan Turing did is that he caught up on the human flaw, that there's some words which you can expect to be in the message. And then he created a machine that could find that word in the message, which is the brilliance of it.
I've got to ask about what you're doing next, because you've been linked with a couple of things since Imitation Game started screening. Chain of Events was one, which was said to be a Da Vinci Code and meets World War Z, which is weird. And Pattern Recognition was
Chain of Event is based on the Swedish novel. Mm-hmm. Actually, it's about the cryptographer.
Ah.
So another film with a cover. It's a phenomenal story, which I've been obsessed with a little bit. It takes place in London.
Oh, again.
So again, back to London. But it's a
It's more of an action-y story, and it's not sci-fi, but it's a big concept story about what would you do if you knew what's going to happen in the future.
Like kind of Minority Report, but not that sci-fi.
Yeah, okay. A little bit, very grounded. So, and it's like, what if, you know, what do you do if you know, sort of like a calendar of yourself and your human race in them anyway.
Right, so it's like a psycho-history thing?
It's a cryptographer. They find out that there's actually a hidden code in our DNA that actually tells the story of what's going to happen in the future.
Intriguing.
Okay, yeah, I'm interested.
it's a really cool action thriller, and it's a big movie that I'm developing for Warner, so it's really great.
Cool. And then is that going to be next, do you think, or does it depend?
You never know what's going to be next and what's going to happen, but it's something which I'm getting. Mark L. Smith is writing it, who just wrote The Revenant, which is the movie that Alejandro is now shooting with Leo DiCaprio. So he's sending in a new script end of this week.
Wow.
We're doing a rewrite, so we're going to hand it to Warner, and then I'm very excited about that one. It's a really cool project. And then Pattern Recognition is a great novel by William Gibson, which again is, I think you always end up doing more or less a little bit same story. Again, it's an outsider escape, which I think, you know, Imitation Game is a movie about outsiders. It's about, you know, different thinking people, and that celebrates being different. Mm-hmm. And Pattern Recognition is but it's a female character, and it's slightly sci-fi.
Okay.
But sort of like sci-fi that I love, that is more alternative. It's like it happens today, but it has sci-fi element to it.
Okay, yeah.
So like alternative things today.
Mm.
And
Gibson's kind of interesting because he's an incredibly influential author.
Oh, completely.
But he hasn't really been done properly, certainly.
It is challenging to do his script, because there's the actual plot is not always the important thing in his movies. Is, you know, there's the ideas and characters and the feel of it, which is more so. But he's the man in cyberspace. I mean, that comes from his book.
Yeah.
You know, and it's and he's always been very accurate about foreseeing things, you know, and how we deal with, and also he's one of the authors that doesn't say that internet and social media necessarily is sort of like, wow, it's like bad and it's going to turn on us and it's really frightening, you know. He sort of like celebrates it a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time.
You're welcome. And, my pleasure.
And fingers crossed for the movie, which is out obviously on Friday, today.
Thank you so much.
So let's start with The Imitation Game now, as we dig into this week's big releases. Hell's Bells.
Yes, so this is Benedict Cumberbatch playing another antisocial but incredibly gifted individual. Alan Turing is a mathematician called upon by the British government to come and work at Bletchley Park and try to break the essentially unbreakable, as Morton Tilden said in that interview. It remains an unbreakable code. You need some kind of human error to be able to break the Enigma code, and he comes up with a way. So that isn't really a spoiler. It's pretty much set out at the beginning of the film, and also is history, and you should know it already. Keira Knightley plays one of his colleagues, Matthew Good, and Alan Leach, who you know from Downton Abbey.
Formerly of this chair.
Formerly of this chair, yes. Are also in his group of code breakers, and they're all under pressure from Charles Dance, who's the sort of general in charge of the operation, and from Mark Strong, who's the boss of the nascent MI6, who's trying to kind of oversee everything and make sure it stays super top secret. Now, this is all framed by, there's kind of two framing devices. There's the flash forwards, or the framing device of the 1950s, where Turing reports a break into his house, but nothing is taken. And this sort of sparks the interest of an investigating policeman who starts to look into his war record, finds, you know, that there's nothing there, and starts to believe that Turing may be a spy for the other side. What he uncovers, of course, is the fact that Turing was homosexual, which was a criminal offence, unbelievably, at the time. And so, you know, the tragic and awful and really unforgivable persecution of this man by the British state was then sort of sparked off from that. So that's one sort of framing device. There are also flashbacks to his childhood, which show, in a slightly on-the-nose manner, some of the ways that he became you know, who he became, why he became interested in code in the first place, and so on. So it's really kind of a gamble, gander through the man's life. It is much funnier than you might expect. Mark Strong in particular, it sort of breaks the tension but doesn't destroy the tension, if you know what I mean. Turing himself is also very funny just from his, you know, complete inability to act like a normal person quite a lot of the time, and then everyone else sort of carries, I think, a lot of the drama. But, you know, as Tilden said there in that interview, I think, you know, giving you those comic moments does actually mean that the emotional bits hit quite hard afterwards. So it's actually pretty good going. I think it's mostly a conventional biopic within those framing devices, okay. But it's very good stuff.
Phil, what you liked this as well, didn't you?
I liked it. I didn't like it perhaps as much as some people seem to have done. It's a film that we've discussed quite a lot at work,
yeah,
around our desks. I wasn't quite as up on it as our review, which is 4 stars,
yeah,
has been, or necessarily understanding quite the level of Oscar buzz that it's accruing. I think Benedict Cumberbatch is really, really good. I think he's sort of on the spectrum a bit, his character, isn't he? There's a hint of Asperger's in the way that he can't quite relate to those people around him, which creates lots of interesting friction.
Yeah.
Because this is a film about interpersonal relationships as much as anything. But I thought some of the dialogue and some of the characterization was a little, I think we make the point in the review actually, a little on the nose. Some of the sequences. There's a moment where they break the code where they have to, it's that, you know, with great power comes great responsibility moment where they have to work out how they can use the information without giving away the fact that they have the information to the Germans by, you know, making it obvious. And that involves a convoy upon which one of the team's brother is sailing and some U-boats. And you can kind of imagine how that all plays out. But I just thought that it could have been a little bit more subtle, the way some of that stuff was conveyed. But it's a very complicated story, so I can kind of understand the way that it's been framed, and they get a lot into it. But yes, I would say I enjoyed it a lot, perhaps not quite to the same level as some others have.
Okay, dogs. Nick, this was a Blacklist winner a couple of years ago. The screenwriter Graham Moore, yeah, won the Blacklist with this script. At the time, Leonardo DiCaprio was attached. I kind of find it hard to picture him as Alan Turing, but Benedict Cumberbatch?
Yeah, he's very good, Cumberbatch. I mean, the performance is quite close to Sherlock. It's not, you know, he is the troubled genius who doesn't get on well with others, is a bit eccentric. So I thought it was a very good performance, but perhaps not the astonishing Oscar, you know, buzzy type thing that some people are saying, because it was quite close to what we've seen him do before. But no, I'm somewhere between Helen and Phil. I didn't know, that wasn't really familiar with the story, so I found it very interesting, but I thought it was quite clunky at places. And there's sort of cutaways to the war that basically look like bits from the World at War documentary.
I'd seen all of
like
those
a tank
in World at War
in Slough. Yeah, I mean, I wasn't blown away by it.
I would actually agree that I think some of the Oscar buzz is a little bit OTT. My early favourite is probably Eddie Redmayne at the moment for Theory of Everything. Another maths genius. It's that kind of a year, guys.
Harvey Weinstein paid a lot of money for this movie. He saw something in it that's very Oscar worthy.
Yeah.
I don't know quite what that is, but it seems to be.
Fine.
But it's one of those films that feels like it's straining for that.
Yes.
It feels like it's, you know, the score and everything is.
I don't think so.
Really?
Just because of the humour, I think it sort of, it doesn't feel quite as worthy as I expected it. I expected it to feel like a, you know, a high fibre meal. Going in, you know, really worthy and good for you, but not necessarily enjoyable. But actually, you know, there's some really nice bits of bacon in there, if you will. I'm not sure where I'm going with this. Let me move on.
I'm never coming over for lunch. Honestly. Bury a meal. Delicious. Well, yeah, worth pointing out on that, Mark Strong brings a little slightly unusual comic relief in some of his, because he's the head of MI. He's the head of MI6, yeah, as is, as Secret Intelligence Service, as was, and he turns up and he's very cloak and dagger in every single thing he says. He's like, oh, danger, an espionage, that'd be right up my alley. And you're like, well, obviously, you're running the thing. And then he'll go and hide behind a curtain and then poke his head out.
He did,
more
he
danger.
Did, he stole the show. Good old Mark Strong.
He could be have a solo movie in the Imitation Gameverse.
Oh, I'd love to see that. Genuinely, that guy's, his character's fascinating and he should have his own movie.
Okay, fantastic. So 4 stars then for The Imitation Game. If you do want to double bill it with Enigma, the 2002 movie starring Dick Ray Scott and Kate Winslet and the world's slowest car chase, don't.
Don't.
Don't do that. Absolutely don't do that. Helen, you have to go, don't you?
I do.
You have a set visit on a movie that we cannot reveal.
No.
At this point in time.
It's if you think of the most ridiculous title of any movie coming out in the next 2 years, it's that one.
It's that one. We've discussed it many times in the podcast and always in favourable terms. All right, off you go.
Bye, bye, thanks all, bye.
Bye. Alone at Last, boys.
That's sinister.
It sounded a little bit more sinister than I intended. I intended it to be very sinister, so that's good.
Back on,
the next film is The Drop, which stars Tom Hardy, Noomi Rapace, and in his last ever role, the late, great James Gandolfini. Phil, what can you tell us about this?
That's right. Well, first of all, the title. It's called The Drop because The Drop is a bar. It keeps moving around Brooklyn where all of the dirty money in town goes to be kept in safekeeping overnight.
So the bar is a different bar. It's like it's a movable feast.
It is a movable feast. Each bar has a little kind of sort of slot in the bar and a safe belief. It's all kind of a complex system. Everybody in the know knows where it is. And the sort of implication is that one night it's going to be the bar that Tom Hardy's character works in as a barkeep. He works for his boss is James Gandolfini's character. James Gandolfini playing a little bit to type. Great to see him, obviously, and it's his last role. Disappointing, perhaps, in a way that he wasn't given slightly more to do, I suppose. Slightly different kind of role in this one. Anyway, so Tom Hardy's character is he's a taciturn, quiet guy who doesn't really find it easy to articulate himself, but he has depths that kind of gradually unpeel themselves during the course of the movie, and he falls in with Noomi Rapace's character over a dog that he finds in a dustbin outside a house, which brings him into conflict with Matthias Schoenaerts, her ex-boyfriend. Mm. So that's the basic framework of it, but within this is this idea that the dirty money by some Eastern European gangsters will be coming to the bar. Exactly who's involved in trying to rip off who. Tom Hardy's character is the heart of the film, and he is fantastic in this. He plays this guy who, as I say, is emotional, a little bit kind of inarticulate, but through his relationship with this little puppy and through his relationship with Noomi Rapace, and to a certain extent his relationship with Gandolfini's character, you see the nobility in this guy, and you see that there's a lot more to him than meets the eye. There's some Eastern European gangsters, there's dirty money, there's all these kind of basic crime tropes which you'd expect from a Denis Lehane adaptation. And what did you think, bro?
Yeah, it was. So this is based on a short story by Denis Lehane, who obviously did Gone Baby Gone, Shutter Island, and it was the short story is set in Boston. They moved it for the film to Brooklyn, so we haven't got to hear Tom Hardy's Boston accent yet. The film was originally called Animal Rescue, which they changed after they finished shooting because they were worried it would sound like Marley and Me. I liked the film without loving it. I was actually on set in Brooklyn, so I got to hang out in that bar and watch Tom Hardy pouring pints of Heineken, which was exciting. There was no Gandolfini there, sadly. I liked it, but it's fairly unremarkable, to be honest. It was a bit disappointing. I'm a big fan of Denis Lehane. It's not up there with his other screen adaptations. But very strong performances. But as you say, everyone is kind of doing things which you've kind of seen them do already. I don't think there's anything earth-shattering, particularly.
No, yeah, I'd agree with that. I think maybe Hardy's probably the one that's pushed furthest out of his comfort zone. But it's interestingly cast, because it's a very American milieu. I mean, we've seen this 1,000 times, this sort of 70s, the verdict is another, you know, the kind of the grimy bar where someone goes and props it up and drama unfolds around that setting. And yet this is populated with, you know, European actors, really. Tom Hardy,
Noomi Rapace,
Matthias Schoenaerts.
European director as well.
And a European director. It's interesting, but yet you don't really get a strong sense of anything particularly new to this kind of world, which is a shame. It's very watchable. It's probably, you know, your ideal plane movie, I would say. I'm not sure. You know, we gave it 3 stars, a recommendation. Whether you'd go and see it at the cinema on the big screen or wait for a DVD or wait for on demand, I'm not sure with this one. Tom Hardy's very, very watchable in everything he does.
The dog is good.
The puppy is adorable.
The puppy, it's a pit bull, but it's still very cute. Tom Hardy actually has a tattoo of a Rottweiler on his back. So if you ever meet him, I'll
have
to show you that. In real life, he is a dog fanatic. And he has a zillion dogs.
Does he? How many dogs were on this film? Was there just one?
There was about six or seven.
Really?
Yeah, because they kept growing, and it has a puppy, so they had to keep changing it.
Oh, good point.
So, yeah, there we go.
What a lovely, lovely puppy. I'll give you a stroke. No, it's not the time for pedigree jam. That comes later.
3 stars for
three
The
stars.
Drop, which is a recommendation. Okay, and Nick, you're up next with Life Itself, which is a documentary about the late, great film critic Roger Ebert.
The great Roger Ebert. And filmmaker, because he co-wrote
Beyond the Valley of the Dolls.
Beyond the Valley of the Dolls.
Yeah.
Much, boobs and
much boobs,
boobs and guns and all kinds of stuff, which you wouldn't really expect from him. If you were going to imagine what Roger Ebert would have written, that it's quite funny what came out. Anyway, I've just written my top 20 list of the year, and this comes quite high up. I really enjoyed this. I'm a big fan of Roger Ebert anyway, but I just really like this, and there's a really lovely circularity in that this film is directed by Steve James, who is the documentary maker who made Hoop Dreams, which Roger Ebert raved about when it came out and gave it this top rating. And so it's really nice that he's now making this film about Roger Ebert. When they started making it, they weren't aware that Roger Ebert had a terminal illness, and that came about during the making of this film. And so this film really morphed while they were making it into the last days of Roger Ebert, as well as being a sort of talking heads documentary. So you get footage of him in the hospital, you know, with his jaw removed and all kinds of stuff, but he's still upbeat and he's still funny, and you get a really great sense of Ebert's personality and just the optimism and the upbeatness of this guy, which comes across in his writing. But it's a really, really, really nice documentary. He's got some big names in there. Martin Scorsese is really funny.
Were there any filmmakers he didn't get on with? Anyone who you had friction with?
I remember he didn't. He had a run-in with Vincent Gallo when he criticised The Brown Bunny. He said it was one of the worst things he'd ever seen of it, you know. And Vincent Gallo took him to task on it. But frankly, that's like bringing a knife to a gunfight. Vincent Gallo versus Roger Ebert.
I'm sure he made enemies. He was pretty. I actually have a collection of Roger Ebert reviews, which is one-star reviews that he wrote, because he was hysterical when he hated a film.
So your movie sucks.
Your movie sucks, and he would just go berserk on a film, and so that's worth picking up. But yeah, it's a really nice film. One of my favourite documentaries of the year. So I would check that out.
Indeed. 4 stars for Life Itself. If you're a fan of film, and I guess if you're a fan of film criticism and Roger Ebert, it's a must-see. Also out this week is Paul Haggis' latest movie, Third Person, which is a sort of portmanteau romance thing. William Neeson, Olivia Wilde, Mila Kunis. Good cast, but sadly the film doesn't quite live up to its promise. 2 stars for Third Person. And Nativity 3, Dude, Where's My Donkey, as foretold in the Book of Revelation, has finally dropped into cinemas, and we also gave that one 2 stars. Martin Freeman was in the first movie. Then David Tennant was in the second movie. Martin Clunes is the star of the third movie. I'm not saying that in any way to denigrate Martin Clunes. I'm a big fan of Men Behaving Badly and certain episodes of Doc Martin.
Is the star of part 4 going to be a rock with a face painted on
it? It may well be. But these movies are huge. The last one made 10 million quid in the UK, apparently. 10 million quid!
Just half Mrs. Brown's Boys.
Don't get me started. 2 stars for Nativity 3, Dude, Where's My Donkey? I don't think any of you are going to willingly go and see it this week. If you're parents, you may be forced by your kids at gunpoint to go along and see this movie. So there you go. 2 stars for that. And that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun, when we'll be joined by Chadwick Boseman, star of the James Brown biopic Get On Up. And sadly, that was recorded before he became Marvel's Black Panther, so don't come sniffing around for scoopage on that film. Do come sniffing around, because it's a damn good interview. There you go. We'll also be joined by the directors of the brilliant New Zealand vampire comedy What We Do in the Shadows, Taika Waititi and Jermaine Clement. Yes, that's right, Jermaine from Flight of the Conchords. It's business time, ladies. Until then, Helen's already said goodbye. It's goodbye from Nick.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Phil.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to rewatch Memento, because I sense I'm about to get a lot of hate tweets. Nick, you should probably rewatch Batman Begins. Let's do it this weekend. I'll rewatch Memento, you won't rewatch Batman Begins, and we'll be back here next week and compare the results.
It's a plan.
It's a bloody good plan.